Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Skesmerick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, you can hear an exclusive interview with the Jesuit provincial of the British province. And how Marshall's epigrams make you want to cry. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. As I mentioned a moment ago, we begin today by speaking to Michael Holman, who's Jesuit provincial of the British province. At 51, Father Holman is responsible for a province which embraces Scotland, England and Wales, but also stretches far across the world, from South Africa to Guyana. This soft-spoken Jesuit explains how, in our increasingly secular day and age, more and more we are bringing Christ to those who don't know him, working on the frontiers of the Church. Listen to this exclusive one-to-one interview. You joined the Jesuits quite young, didn't you?
I did. I joined at 19, which in those days wasn't so unusual. It's more usual now to join the Jesuits in perhaps the mid-20s after university.
Was your name Michael then, or was it something you took on?
No, Michael, we don't take on religious names. We keep our family names, yes. We've never had that tradition. It's a monastic tradition, essentially, and our order is, as you know, far from being monastic.
It's far from being monastic. Is that what attracted you to the order?
I think it has to be said that I was both baptised by a Jesuit and educated by a Jesuit. So in a sense, perhaps, I was a Jesuit from the age of seven. As they say, you know, give me a boy at the age of seven and I'll have him for life. Now, what attracted me, I think, very much was the idea of apostolic service, of going out and working in the world and bringing the message of Christ to the world in whatever context that might be. And I think as I'm provincial now, something that strikes me is in Britain we're called to be, I think, people who bring the gospel of Christ to what is very much a secular society. On the one hand, a secular society, yes, that is true. I think people have less a sense of Christ now than they used to have. I don't think that's really because they have denied Christ in any specific sense, but it's more because life is genuinely very hectic, it is very busy. When I was a boy, Sundays were indeed special days, shops were closed, no work was done, but Sunday is becoming increasingly like any other day. People are so much busier in a way Christ has been crowded out of their lives. And I think it's to those people in that situation, many of whom are now looking for meaning and significance in life, that we are called to bring the gospel of Christ. As I like to put it, I think we Jesuits work on the frontiers of the Church with those perhaps who don't believe but would like to believe, while being at the same time very much tied to the centre of the Church.
So you think that your charism is particularly suitable for a crisis situation, as it were?
Yeah, I think it's a missionary charism. I think Jesuits are essentially missionary. And if I think of my own group of Jesuits, the British Jesuits, we were very much missionary in our origins. The first Jesuit came from Europe in 1580 to a Protestant country to support those who had remained faithful to the Catholic Church in England. And the name of that Jesuit is Edmund Campion. And our tradition since then has been missionary. I suppose it has to be said, in the 19th and 20th centuries, we became very much part of the establishment of the Church. The Catholic Church was legalised in Britain in the early 19th century.
And Pius the Ninth.
During the time of Pius the Ninth and his predecessor, in fact. And it was a time of consolidating the Church in Britain. It was a time for building churches, literally. It was a time for establishing secondary schools, and we had, at our peak, 10 secondary schools in Britain. But now I think the time is to return to our missionary roots as British Jesuits, and once again to bring this gospel of Christ that means so much to us. We are, after all, as Jesuits, companions of Jesus, and there is a sense in which we can't rest until other people know of this Christ who is our close companion in life. So we are missionary once again.
Your Ignatian charism has a two-pronged approach from what you're saying then. Mm-hmm. On the one side you have the spiritual, and on the other hand you have the ministry, the actual down to earth. You've done both of that, haven't you, in your life as a Jesuit? I read in your biography that you've worked in prisons as a chaplain and in hospitals as a chaplain.
That's right.
How do you deal with that double-pronged approach and that?
I think one of the most moving experiences of my life was when I was working for about 6 months in a part of the world that is attached to the British province, that's Guyana in South America. And while I was in Guyana for that short period of time, I worked as a chaplain, particularly in the prison there. And one of my jobs was, with the Anglican chaplain, to visit each week those men who were condemned to death. So we used literally to walk from cell to cell. I can remember one man called George Thomas was his name, and he'd been convicted of a murder, and he would stand up at the bars of his prison cell, talk to me through, if you like, the little window there, and he would recite to me the 51st Psalm, and he would talk to me about how he had been converted in prison. He has since been hanged. I wasn't around when he was hanged. He has since been hanged. Now, I suppose that's a very active apostolic thing to do, to visit men who are on death row in prison. But I think as one reflects upon one's day at the end of our day, which is something St. Ignatius taught us very much to do, what could we do but find Christ talking to us in that man who had experienced that conversion in that situation, and he was living right opposite a door, as he showed me, that took him to the place where he would be hanged. And sure enough, about 18 months later, he was hanged. Now, there you contemplate Christ in the middle of life. I think that's something that's very much part of the charism of the society. It's to be men working in the world, but finding Christ in the world. And I suppose that's one example of how I find Christ in the world.
Yet it's a very difficult chore that you have. I'm using the word chore because there are declining numbers of Jesuits in the world. It used to be a very powerful order, and now the numbers have declined immensely. Yes. Why is this, do you think?
The world has changed very much, and indeed the Church has changed very much. I think we would both remember a time when Catholic schools, perhaps back in Britain, were primarily run either by priests like me, or brothers or sisters of religious orders of one type or another. And we could say the same for hospitals, Catholic hospitals, and we could probably say the same that in many Catholic parishes you would find brothers and sisters working on the social ministries of the Church. Now the time has changed, and lay people are doing those jobs. There is so much more openness to lay ministry in the Church than there was previously. And so there is a way in which, if you wish to serve the Church, you can do that as a committed layperson. That is, shall we say, different to what it was 30 years ago. And of course, that has impacted on active religious orders like the Society of Jesus, like my own order. But I think one thing we now do, and we do very much, say in our schools in Britain, is that we support those men and women who work with us in our schools so that they find a support in what gives us a support, namely in the spirituality of Ignatius, that enables them to find God in the needs of the young men and the young women whom they teach each and every day. And this can make an ordinary life, shall we say, being a teacher, into something quite extraordinary, where you can grow in your contemplation of Christ in the needs of men and women, young men, young women, in the course of every day.
Today, when one speaks about retreats, one always speaks about the Ignatian spirituality, the exercises of St. Ignatius. St. Ignatius was a soldier, who was an aristocratic soldier.
Indeed.
It seems a bit strange. I think possibly he was preparing for a state of war, in a sense.
Yes.
And yet he wrote these spiritual exercises. Isn't that a contradiction? Isn't there a contradiction there?
Spirituality is the way in which many men and women who, for whatever reason, didn't find religion and the message of Christ alive in their lives in earlier life, in later life perhaps, maybe in middle age, maybe even younger, that they are coming to find Christ through spirituality. I read a piece recently that really struck me. It was an edition, a Spanish edition, of the autobiography of St. Ignatius, and at the end of this autobiography, this man who edited this piece was asking, well, what is it that's specific about Jesuit spirituality? And it is that we can find Christ in the middle of the world, in the center of our world. We don't have to withdraw from our world in order to find Christ, but we can find him meeting us right here, right there. That's something Ignatius did, and through his experiences of conversion in Loyola and the castle of Loyola, we have learned a great deal of how we can come to that moment of conversion. How we can hear his call in our lives to follow him, to love him, and to serve him. And I think that combination of loving and that combination of serving is something that's very specific, and it's something that people are looking for today. If you like, they want to love Christ, but they also want to serve him. It's what gives, if you like, the gospel credibility, the capacity to serve Christ in the middle of the world and above all those who are most marginalized and those who are poorest. That is also a very attractive feature of the way Jesuits live their spirituality.
You live your spirituality as a society, don't you? I mean, you were founded by free people.
Well, we are celebrating this year, as many of your listeners may know, we are celebrating the 500th anniversary of the birth of Francis Xavier, whom one bishop recently described as the greatest apostle missionary since St. Paul. There we are, maybe that's open to question. But also the 450th anniversary of the death of St. Ignatius, and the 500th anniversary of someone who's far less well known. He is Blessed Peter Faber. He was from Savoy, and he was the very first companion of Ignatius. Ignatius met him in Paris when they were both students in Paris. And later on, Peter Faber would write that the best moment of his life, that moment of his life for which he gives most thanks for, is that time when he taught Ignatius about Aristotle in the university, and Ignatius taught him about God. Peter Faber, who later went on to be an apostle, not in the East, India, China, Japan, and like Francis Xavier, but perhaps in even more difficult circumstances in Reformation Europe, in places like Cologne and in the Netherlands, who brought the gospel of Christ by being a man of conversation, and above all, a man of love and a man of friendship, who won people over by the attractiveness of Christ. We're also celebrating him and his specific kind of missionary spirit, which I think, if you're working in a secular world today, has an awful lot to say to us about how we can go about being missionaries in the secular society.
Do you think the Ignatian charism, the Jesuit charism, do you think it brings light into people's lives?
It's certainly been my experience. One of the activities in which I've been involved as a Jesuit, not only in secondary schools, where I was the director of a school for many years, I've also been involved in directing 30-day retreats, 8-day retreats, according to the method of St. Ignatius and the spiritual exercises. Does it bring light into those people's lives? Undoubtedly it does. I think most of all, as they experience the fact that the best news of all is indeed news for them, that Christ doesn't condemn us, but Christ loves us. He looks at us and he doesn't say no. He says yes, yes, and yes again. And that experience of the forgiveness of Christ, the compassion of Christ, the love of Christ, with me as I am, is a converting experience. Once you've experienced that love, what do you want to do? You want to get to know this Christ who loves us so much, that much better. And you want to follow him, and you want to give your life for him, even if that means going to the cross. But you know that if you go to the cross, you also come through to the resurrection. And that, I suppose, is the rhythm of the spiritual exercises. So does it bring light into people's lives? I'd say yes, definitely.
Can I ask you a more personal question?
Sure.
What is the highlight of your life as a priest and as a Jesuit in particular?
I would go back to that time in Guyana, certainly. I would go back to that prison. I would go back to that man standing at his cell door. I would go again to Guyana, to Georgetown, the capital city, and I would go to the hospital there, the public hospital there. And I can remember coming into the ward that was dedicated to AIDS patients. Now, in those days, and we're talking about 12 years ago, perhaps there wasn't the kind of understanding of this disease that there might be now. And it was a very poor place. The men there had little food. They would be lying sometimes two to a bed. I came across one patient who had just died in that ward. Talking to those men, talking to them about their experience, talking to them about their view of a future that was death, and shortly death to be encountered, of how much they longed for Christ and they longed for his forgiveness. I think I will never forget that for as long as I live. And you try and bring compassion into their lives. You try and bring a word that makes a difference to their lives. And nothing brings a word that makes a difference to their lives other than the word that Christ loves them and Christ will not let go of them, that he is on their side even in this situation, and that when the worst appears to happen, and for many of us death is the worst, it is in fact the best of all, because we realize that in Christ we have someone who indeed never let us go in life and certainly never lets us go in death either. The work of education, to which I gave much of my life after Guyana, is hugely important as well. The privilege of working with so many, I had 1,500 boys, as it happened, between the age of 11 and 18 in the school in Wimbledon in South London. They were every education ability, they were from every ethnic background, and they were from every socio-economic background too, because the school was free, there were no fees charged, so it was open to those who wanted to come. I would say that that has also been a highlight of my life, and the opportunity to have an effect on young people through their daily living in an environment that one hopes was shaped and influenced by the gospel of Christ. Perhaps even more so than their religious education classes. Young people don't always take as well to a religious education as they might do, you know. But to be able to live, grow up in a context that was shaped by the values of forgiveness, that was shaped by the values of service, that was shaped by the values of respect for each other. Going the extra mile for those young people who were in a difficult time, having a difficult time perhaps with their families, as many of them did, I'd say, you know, that was a highlight of my life too. That's more ordinary, but ordinary things can also be highlights.
Our thanks there go to the Jesuit provincial of the British province, Father Michael Holman. And now hold tight, as it's time to join our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. As always, passionate and full of surprises. Stay tuned. I read this reference to Marshall in H.V. Morton's book.
We're reading Marshall in two classes now.
And what
the
are
you fourth
reading
experience,
around?
I mean, his glorious epigrams. One better than the other. I just cry. I mean, they're so beautiful and so human and so neat.
What do they speak about?
Everything.
Well,
of course,
this is what I was
gonna there are 1,500 of them. And they talk about everyone, people's teeth and their hairdos and their shoes and their bow legs and everything else.
How do you say bow legs?
Well, okay. He said this person is so bow-legged that he has to wash his feet in one of those horns, you know, like a horn that, you know, curved horn. I mean, this is Marshall's out of this world. Well, there's another famous one I gave to the students. And this man, he was bald like I am, and he used to paint hair on his head, as some people are still doing today, you know, like shoe polish, black shoe polish, you know. And so Marshall said, this guy doesn't need a barber, he needs a sponge.
You say that in Latin.
Non opus est ei. Non opus est ei tonsores et spongia. Marshall. What does Morton say?
Marshall talks about the dress code of the Romans, like their togas.
Yeah, everything.
So is it true that according to what they wore, for example, if they wore a red stripe on their toga, they were going off to feed the sacred pullets.
The sacred what?
Pullets.
Pullets. What are these geese or something? Wow, I don't know about the red thing. Well, anyway, but it was the purple thing was the important. The senators, the children, and senators had purple.
Senators and children.
Yes.
Why senators and children?
I don't know why, but when the children became of age, like 17 and stuff, then they took off that purple stripe on their togas.
It's curious, isn't it, that the senators and the children have the same stripe?
Yeah, they had a purple stripe on the bottom of their togas. Boop.
What other stripes were there?
That was, as far as I know.
How would you describe
as colors?
If you had to describe the American flag, stars and stripes, how would you say that in Latin?
Stars and stripes. I know. What are you going to say? Stelle et... Huh. I have to think. Stelle is all right. Stars and stripes. What are you going to... No. Like a zebra.
Anyway, getting back to this epigram of Marshall, I was very struck by how the Romans used water clocks.
Oh, yeah.
And so Marshall addressed one of his epigrams to a long-winded lawyer.
Yeah. Klepsydra. Klepsydra or Klepsydra.
That's of Greek origin, isn't it?
Yeah, Klepsydra. For sure, yeah. Klepsydra. And water clocks or sand clocks. They had sand clocks, too.
Pliny mentions that during an important case, he was allowed 10 large clepsydra. But after speaking for nearly 5 hours, he had not finished. The case was so important, however, that he was granted 4 extra clepsydra. So what's Pliny doing talking about the time?
Well, no, he had a watch. I mean, they say time's up, your time is up, because the water is out of the clock.
So this is when Marshall comes in. Marshall addressed one of his epigrams to a long-winded lawyer.
And says,
how does one say a long-winded lawyer?
Loquacissimus advocatus.
Well, that's cheating, because loquacissimus is loquacious. So you're saying loquacious
lawyer. Well,
long-winded, lawyer.
What are you going to say?
Loquacious lawyer.
Okay.
Cheating.
Well, cheating.
Anyway, Marshall says, the judge has reluctantly allowed you 7 water clocks, Cecilianus, he wrote. But you talk so long and so loud with your head thrown back, swilling tepid water all the time out of the glasses, to satisfy your oratory and your thirst, we beg you, Cecilianus, drink out of the water clock itself.
Ah.
How do you say that? How do you tell that story?
Oh, my Lord, I don't know. I have to look up. I can find it in 10 seconds.
No, well, I mean, I don't need the exact translation, but just...
Satisfy what oratorie vi satisfacias atque siti obsecramus te Ceciliane bibe ex clepsedra ipsa. Drink from the water clock itself and stop, you know, the time. No, Marshall's out of this world. Oh, he's out. Of course, he can be very obscene and very kind of coarse. But, I mean, in a certain pure and wholesome way.
Who are the Centumviri?
Centumviri, yeah. This is like
Centumviri.
Yeah, like a 100-man commission. They would like to have a commission. Usually not with the... Like for different like public works and stuff, they would have 100-man commission. Centumviri.
Centumviri. And
the duumviri were like the two men in charge of the city.
But in these great trials in the Basilica Julia, in the forum,
yeah,
he says
that's on the other side over there.
The centumviri, when they were in session.
Okay, those would be like the 100-man, like judges all around.
Uh-huh. There were so many people in the basilica itself that the lawyers had to shout to make themselves heard. So how do you say the lawyers have to shout to make themselves heard?
Clamandum fuit ut audirentur. Clamandum fuit ut audirentur.
And sometimes the proceedings...
It had to be shouted that they might be heard because everyone was mumbling and, you know, the Italians, you know...
But there were the Laudi Ceni as well. The Laudi Ceni, in my book, says that there were the paid applauders. Like on TV today, when they pay people to go and applaud.
Laudi Ceni, okay.
You've never heard of it. They invent things sometimes, don't they?
Oh, that's incredible. I mean, Marshall tells us everything. He says, you have false teeth now. They had false teeth. And Marshall says, now, that's nice you have false teeth. What are you going to do with your eye? You know, in those days, they didn't have glass eyes. Mm. He said, that's fine that you have false teeth now. What are you going to do with your...
How do you say that in Latin?
With your blind eye.
Glass eye.
Quid oculo facies? Quid oculo facies? What are you going to do with your eye?
And the false teeth?
Oh, no, there was no problem. So dentis factici. They had everything.
They had everything, but they talk about implantology now for teeth. How do you say that?
Oh, implantology. Now, I don't... Okay. De dentibus inserendis. That's easy. Dentiscalpium is a wooden thing. You know, what do you have? You a pick. What do you have? A pick for your
toothpick.
Teeth? Toothpick. A toothpick. They had all that stuff. So it's interesting to read Marshall. You should read Marshall in any language. You'll just laugh all day and be surprised.
A huge thank you there to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite father, Reginald Foster, and he's currently working in the Vatican as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. If you did, please let me know. Our email address is english@vatiradio.va. Or if you wish to drop me a line, the address is The English Programme, Vatican Radio, Vatican City. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Be sure to check out our website. The address is vaticanradio.org/English. Bye for now, and don't forget that we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.